Welcome to the Runners Roundtable podcast. Season 4 is Conversations with Runners, and each episode features a conversation with an inspiring female runner who is making the running community better in her own way. In this episode, I'm talking to Allison Mariella Desir about the weaving of histories through her book, Running While Black. We also talk about how she uses movement as a path towards disrupting the status quo in running in order to create a future where all are visible and feel like they belong. Enjoy this episode and thanks for listening. Welcome everyone to the final episode of season 4 of the Runners Roundtable, where this season I have been talking to some incredible, inspiring, empowering women in the running space that are changing what it means to be a runner. And I am so just like geeking out, and I've been geeking out since you responded yes to my request to being on the podcast, but I am speaking to Allison Mariella Desir today. And I feel like you need no introduction, you know, just in case for the people who do need an introduction, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into running?
Sure. Thank you for having me. I am a mother. I'm a runner. I'm an author. I am the host of a PBS show called Out and Back with Allison Mariella Desir. And all of my work is really at the intersection of movement, mental health, and racial equity. I started running long distance in 2012, totally unexpectedly, just after seeing a friend of mine training for a marathon, and as marathon runners do, talk about how it was, you know, changing his life. And I decided to sign up for my first marathon, and it made such an impact on my mental health. Like, I went from, you know, not wanting to get out of bed, feeling depressed and anxious, to realizing that I could do really difficult things. And that introduction to long distance running, you know, just let me know that my life's work would be about this. It would be about introducing more people to the power of movement and how it really can change your life.
Yeah. And I have your book, which is behind you, Running While Black. And I felt like there's so much you talk about in this book, but one of the things that really stood out to me was the fact that your purpose can be found in movement, right? Mm-hmm. Like, your purpose can be found in running and in sharing that for others. And I think that was something that I struggled with a lot, because mm-hmm. running wasn't something people did for fun for me mm-hmm. growing up. Like, that's kind of not what we did, and that we didn't have the time to run. I mean, I can recall vividly maybe two times that I saw my mother running, but it was because she was trying to lose weight. So I didn't even know that running was something we could do just to do. So reading your book where you're like, this is my purpose, I was like, oh yes, that can be a purpose. And for me, that felt like a permission slip to say, wait, we can use movement as this thing to talk about greater things, which again, in reading your book, there were two things that really stood out to me. And I'm curious if these, just how you felt about it, because I felt like two really big themes of your book, and I'm just diving into your book, were these ideas of invisibility and space, and how you were shedding light not only on your own history as a runner, your own personal history, but the historical history and how so much of it is unknown to everybody. Mm. But then also this creation of space where you could come and be who you are, and then you can invite others to come and be who they are. So that for me, I was like, oh, invisibility, making the invisible visible.
Yeah.
And then the creation of new space. It, to me, it was just so much of it was like a permission to be like, oh, wait, I can actually take up space and talk about these things and feel these way, like feel these things. So.
Well, I'm so glad to hear that.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Because this, I mean, I was like my daughters were like, why are you writing? Why are you taking notes? I'm like, because there's really good things in here. So, you know, I know that. And again, I'm assuming people know who you are, but you had talked about how the book had a different title working title, and then it ended up changing. So can you walk us through just a little bit of what your process was like for writing this book? Because as I'm assuming, it had to have been very challenging and hopefully also very healing for you to write these words.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you said a lot of things, so I'm going to go back a little bit to the piece about invisibility. And definitely, invisibility and hypervisibility is one of the big themes in my book, because the being a Black person, a Black woman in this country, is a mix of being invisible when it comes to our history, when it comes to our identity, but then also being hypervisible in the way that we're policed and in the way that our culture is co-opted, right? So it's really that dichotomy there of feeling like you're or feeling invisible and yet being hypervisible in ways at the same time. And the idea of creating space has always been the work that I've done, even when I was a child, not knowing that that's what I was doing. But, and it's funny because now I see it in my son too, but I was always the one who was reaching out to the person who, was picked last, right? Or reaching, always the person trying to welcome somebody into a space. And that's just, I guess a part of it is how I was raised, but it's also just who I am. And so as I've gotten older, I've realized, oh, that's a quality that I have, and that's something that I can be even more intentional about. Because honestly, what are we all searching for in this life? We're searching for a sense of belonging. We're searching for people to accept us for who we are, right? So creating space, making space is something that I'm really passionate about. My book, the original title, so it's called now Running While Black. The original title was called The Unbearable Whiteness of Running, which I still love that title, but my editor made the point that if that were the name, then I'd be centering whiteness in my book, which is not the purpose of my book. The purpose of my book is to center my experience, our experiences, and decenter whiteness. So while that was more provocative, it really sort of missed the point of what I was trying to make anyway. So, that's why it's always great to have good editors. And I'm really thankful with the title and the way that it taps into, some of the biggest themes of the book.
Yeah, I mean, I read the book and it's in some of my closest network of friends. We have this thing, and I'm gonna curse right now, but we always like we're like, fuck the patriarchy, and then we'll say the time that it happens. We're like, okay, well, we made it to, at this point for me in Miami, I'm like, I made it to 3:17 p.m. without saying that. And as I read your book, I just kept thinking, I'm like, oh, like even as you described starting Harlem Run and just the reception to you and this group and other men and all of that was just so infuriating. And part of what makes it so infuriating for me is because I tell people, oh, you want to get into running? Just go find a run club. Go out there. And it's like, oh, but I can't say that without adding a little asterisk of prepare your heart for possible rejection, or prepare your heart for maybe showing up at this space and like that immediate realization of, oh, this is not the space for me. So as I'm reading all of that, I'm like, oh, you are, and you do bring up, the idea of intersectionality, right? Like there's so many different layers to not only your personal experience of being a runner, but also the experience of making running feel more accessible to your local community. And to me, it's just so disappointing because we can't say, and I've stopped saying it, that running is for everyone when there's so many different gatekeepers and gate people that it's just, it blows my mind. So I'm curious to know, how has that or your perception of that, has it changed since, 2012, that when you ran your first marathon?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the mistakes that the industry, the running industry makes, and also the outdoor industry, which is, broader than just running, is that the way that running is talked about is as if it is for everybody, as if it's super welcoming, as if it's this utopia separate of our actual lives, right? But running really, like, everything in this world is a reflection of this world. So running does not exist outside of patriarchy, outside of racism, outside of homophobia, outside of transphobia. All of those things are a part of anything in this world unless you're actively resisting that, right? So what I was encountering when I started my group, and I still encounter it, is a lot of men in positions of like really just limited power, but wanting to exert it over me. And there's so many people in the New York City running scene who don't support me, so many men, and who I would not partner or collaborate with because they're resistant to me showing up and being my authentic self and, creating space. I think that that's, it's not talked about enough. I'm obviously now not in New York, I'm in Seattle, but I still see conversations and Instagram posts around the very real struggles that women leaders in New York are having because of patriarchy, because of sexism, and they largely go unaddressed because there's no mechanism within the running industry to address it. But I think it's important for people to know, like, movement running is such a powerful, can be such a powerful positive force, but it's not this utopia that's separate of everything else that goes on in our world. So I think, just making sure that when we talk about these things, we couch it with the reality. I'm in a position now where, at the very least, even if people don't respect me, they aren't they recognize me. So and I'm also in a place where I go where I'm wanted and I use my time intentionally. So I'm not looking, if somebody doesn't want me in their space, I'm not looking to get into that space. And that's not just with running groups, that's with events and brands, right? Yes, I want to push those brands to be more inclusive, but also if you're not going to let me in, then I'm just going to create my own thing, right? I'm not going to continue to fight to prove my humanity or why I deserve something.
Yeah, and that's something that I appreciated in your telling of the founding of Harlem Run, where it was like, okay, like you saw a need, then you did that, and you were at least, I'm assuming based off of your words, but it just seems like you were so okay with like, okay, then I'm gonna do it and it's okay. And I'm also not gonna bend over backwards to accommodate you. So beyond running, just to the women who are listening to this, how can we all cultivate more of that attitude of like, this is who I am, and I don't need to prove my worth to you. I don't need to convince you of my worth, because I know for myself, that's something where I always doubt, where I'm like, oh, should I speak up, or should I ask for this amount of money, or do I want to work with this particular brand? Like, now it's a little bit different, but I remember in the beginning with different brands that I worked with, where I was like, oh, someone finally noticed me, so I have to work with them. And now I'm like, you know what? If I'm not going to spend my own hard-earned money on your items, I don't want to work with you. Like, it's okay. So, I mean, it seems like this is kind of always how you've been. I feel like even just like the different projects, like the school projects that you describe in your book, I'm like, okay. Not all of us are like that. So how, I think it's just that. It's what words of encouragement do you have for those of us who are listening, who are like, wait, I want to stand my ground and stand proud in that ground.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a part of it that's just my personality, right? That's clearly from when I was a child. And again, I don't know if it's like my upbringing, like some of it has to just be innate in who I am, that I've always been that way. But that doesn't mean that it's always easy and that it doesn't come with risk or repercussions, right? And I think that the thing about using your voice is that it's like lifting weights, right? The weight doesn't get any lighter, but you are stronger and you can carry that weight more, right? And what I realized for myself is that for me, feeling resentment or feeling taken advantage of are things that I just cannot tolerate, right? Like that, I internalize it and it makes me so much more upset than if I actually say the thing and deal with whatever consequence that is. And when I was younger, I would say those things in more of like an angry way, which there's nothing wrong with that, right? Like you're delivering your message, however it comes out, it comes out. But because I was really angry, because I had been resentful for so long of so many things that I was internalizing. And now I just know that this is what my value is. And if I'm working with a brand, if I'm working with any person, that while I'm super excited that they're interested in me, they also should be interested. Like it has to be mutual, right? So I see the value of working with them. They must see the value of working with me too. And if they don't want to pay me a certain amount, then I just can't do it, right? I can't put myself in a position where that's going to cause me to ruminate and question my worth and feel like I don't want this, right? Like I can't be in that position. And of course, sometimes you have to compromise, obviously, right? Because I'm not a super wealthy person. So there are times when you decide, okay, well, I'm not going to fight this fight. I'm going to swallow it because this is something I need for financial stability, right? But by and large, I try to move in ways that allow me to feel good and comfortable, right? Like it is nothing worse than saying yes to an opportunity and being like, oh, every day, like, why did I do this? I don't want to do that, right? That's not fulfilling, and it's not worth it.
I'm just like, it's so funny hearing you say that. I'm like, oh, that one in particular was not worth it. But what I really appreciate about what you said is it's even just, it starts with you, right? It starts with you being clear as to what your values are and being clear as to what your worth is. And
And also your integrity, right? Because there are so many things that you could say yes to, but if they're not aligned, then you end up just like selling yourself out there for things that you're not compatible with, right? Like you don't want to be associated with a person or a product or an experience that is not aligned with your values. Like you just end up feeling like really yucky inside. So I try to prepare myself to be the best version of myself. And that's by saying yes to things that are aligned and that excite me and that move me in the direction of who I want to be, and no to things that are, who I don't want to be.
movement is so important to you. And as I'm listening to you, I'm like, again, like there's the layers of movement, right? Because it's not only the movement in your physical body of running or hiking or, yoga, whatever it is that you do as movement, but there's also the movement of moving towards becoming that better person or that best version of yourself. And that's something, again, like kind of going back to your book. I really appreciated and you even said it now, how this movement practice of running, how greatly it impacted your mental health. But you're very clear in your book of like, it is no substitute. It's no substitute for therapy, for any kind of medical treatment. And that's something that I find really fascinating when people are like, running is my therapy. And I'm like, yeah, but no, like it
Yeah,
can
and
be.
it's really funny because years ago I wrote the foreword to this book called Running Is My Therapy, right? The purpose of the book is really to talk about the ways that some of the same chemicals that are released in running are similar to those released on certain antidepressants, and depending on your level of anxiety, depression, it can be helpful. But for me, running is therapeutic, and it's a part of a whole range of things that I do for my mental health. And I think that a lot of people who see running as their therapy, then when they face injury or when they face disappointment, their whole world crumbles, right? And I'm not a sports psychologist. I am a mental health counselor, but in sports psychology, there's this concept, I don't know the name of it, but really where you're looking at your life in terms of pillars, right? And so for many people in sports, if they're professional athletes or elites, they have this one pillar of sport. And when they're injured or forced to retire, then suddenly they don't know what to do life after sport, right? So it's all about building up different pillars in your life where you have your sport, you have your family, you have your other interests, because again, when one pillar falls, well, you can still have the others there. And that's what I think is important for everybody, not just athletes, right? What are the you want to have You want to be a full person, who's capable of coping with life, which is disappointing, difficult, scary, all of the above, right? So making sure that you equip yourself to be in the best position.
That's something that I've been reflecting a lot on over the past, I'd say probably a year, maybe 2 years, as my relationship to running has been shifting away from the idea that the only way to be the best runner is to PR, like get the best times. And in that, I really do feel like I'm going against the current sometimes because I'm like, can't we just run for fun and just see what we can do? And it has been very illuminating for me because without that goal of a PR, I've had to really expand what it means to be a runner. And do you mind if I read some of your words to you?
Sure.
Okay, because this is something I like. Just star, 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 star. I understood that the industry, the brands, the media decides who is elevated and visible, who receives funding, who is presented as a runner, and how they are presented. It is the industry who defined who a runner is. And that's just, I can probably quote you for like the rest of the weekend, but I won't do that. But that's one quote that I feel. Just in what you were saying about having these different pillars, it's also, and again, with where I am personally, and understanding that being my best version of a runner means that I take more time to rest, or that being my best version of a runner, like the runner is just that one, but even then it splits into all these other things of like I can be a runner because I like to talk about running. I like to have a podcast. Like you're a runner because you have a book, right? Like there's so many different ways. And I find that whenever there's someone who's new to the sport, they definitely come in with this very specific idea of what it means to be a runner. And your words there were like, you know how sometimes you're like, I know something, but then someone says it and you're like, oh, duh, like, duh. Do you see that that's changing?
I mean, actually, and I don't know if this is just from my vantage point on my little corner of social media, but I'm quite concerned for a lot of people who, like, it seems like right now there's this, everybody's very obsessed with getting their 6 stars for the Abbott World Major. And I don't remember this 10 years ago, 5 years ago. There's something happening where people are really obsessing over this achievement. And for me, it's concerning because people are overtraining. People are looking to run 3 in the same year because they got in. And most of all, because I wonder what this actually means to people. Like, have they stopped to think of why this is meaningful? Or have they seen that this is something that the industry considers meaningful, that the industry says means you're capable? Means you're a worthwhile runner, and therefore they want to achieve that thing. Which, look, I get it because, again, we all want a sense of belonging, we all want to feel seen. But there are so many different amazing races in this world, and this, no doubt, those 6 races are also amazing. But there's nothing inherently more special about Tokyo Marathon than a marathon elsewhere, right? And I wonder what is the meaning attached to these things. Are people really thinking about that? I think to your point, when you first start running, you're really consuming all of these messages about what it means to be a runner. For me now, I have the privilege of living, in Washington State with all of this beautiful scenery, and I realize that being a runner to me means that running is one of the many ways that I engage my body and get outside. But I now really only run like 1 or 2 times a week because, like, I'm cycling and I'm hiking. Again, there's a lot of privilege in all of those things. But I move because it makes my body feel good, because I learn new things. And that's not the only way to be a runner, but I do hope that people are being really thoughtful about what they're doing and how they're assigning meaning to the things that they're doing.
Yeah, listen, I'll give myself as an example here. I have 4 stars, okay? I've ran Berlin, London, New York City, and Chicago. And totally, there's a lot of privilege in that. Like even just, last year I ran London and I'm like, I went to London with my entire family. for a week. And I tell my daughters this all the time. My daughters now, they're 14 and 12. And I told them last year, I'm like, it took me 39 years to be able to travel to London. And here you are, 13 and 11, just going on because your mom wants to run a marathon. Like that to me was like, yeah, if that's not privilege, if that's not an example of privilege, I really don't know what it is. But I had it in my mind where I'm like, oh, I want to get the six stars, six stars, six stars. And then I realized, why do I want the six stars? Like, yeah, it's pretty cool to experience that. And then I realized it, and it connects back to this idea of exclusion, right? Like part of why I wanted it was because not a lot of people have it. And why don't a lot of people have it? And I think, I don't know if you caught this, but Abbott, and I think honestly, to answer your question, short answer is just excellent media, like
I mean,
excellent.
it's a marketing campaign,
Yeah.
and that's what I think people like initially, right? I think Mary Wittenberg was one of the people who built the Abbott World Majors. And again, this is not, I have nothing against Abbott World Majors. I think actually that more people should be able to access it, and the move should be towards making this more inclusive rather than, more elitist. But the idea initially was to create a world stage for the elites to compete in, right? And they were going to have these six world majors, and they were going to be able to make the money that they deserve for winning races. Well, what's quickly happened is that there's this, people are so eager to run those things that really Abbott World Majors is for mass participants, right? And so all of us deciding that we want to do it more makes it more scarce, and somehow people want it more, right? But again, without stopping to think, well, just because something is scarce doesn't inherently make it more valuable, right? Like I don't even know how many marathons I've run, and it's not because I've run a million, but it's because accumulating things doesn't give me meaning. Now, again, I'm not here to tell anybody else that how they make meaning is not valuable, but I do, as a mental health professional, always want to stop and say, like, is this really meaningful for you? Or are you chasing someone else's idea of what success is, right? Like, maybe to be a successful runner for you would actually just to be like running a mile every couple days. But you got so caught on this train of the six majors that here you are, probably like $50,000 in debt, or out the window, because I can't imagine it costing any less than that. Thinking, oh, I still feel unfulfilled, but I just did the thing that I thought I wanted to do.
Yeah, that's why I'm very much so like initially I was like, oh, that's why I want to do it. Like, not a lot of people have it. Like, this is a really special goal. And then I've gotten to the point for me is once I started researching, kind of like, okay, how do I get into the two races that I have remaining, which are Tokyo and Boston? And one, Tokyo is just, that's a big trip. Like, that's a big trip, an expensive trip. It's a lot. And then Boston, honestly, I'm never going to qualify for Boston. I don't want to work that hard to qualify for Boston. And I also don't want to work that hard to raise $10,000. Like, that to me
I mean,
is.
and that's the thing, right? Like, if the Abbott World Majors are going to continue to exist, which they are, they need to figure out how can we make this more accessible for more people, and rethink having a race that is so elitist be part of it, and telling people that that's one of the things that they have to run, right? It's incompatible to say that Abbott World Majors is to get more people interested in moving and reach these goals of making running more accessible when you have the most inaccessible race as one of the requirements, right? So, again, this is not me throwing Abbott World Majors out the window, but this is me asking people to think critically about what that goal means, and what are the ways that we can, with all this money that's being poured into these races, what are the ways that we can ask for more accountability from them to make it truly for us?
Yeah. And I always feel, I feel very mixed about a race like Boston, where I have friends who have ran it, who are going to run it, and I'm incredibly proud of them. But it's like, I worry for myself that I would have the experience you had, where it's like you cross the finish line and you're like, what's so special? Like, I don't get it. And that's something that that again, like reading your words on top of me, just trying to figure out like logistically, how would I get these 6 stars, and realizing like there's an effort level there just to get into the race that I don't think I have. So at this point, I'm like just negotiating with the universe that if I'm meant to run these races, I'll like be invited or something, you know, like something where it's like, oh, okay, where the path is clear and I don't feel like I have to do too much extra. But I want to pivot because you talked about Boston and you are doing a lot to, I feel like, change our relationship to the sport of running and to the space of running. So, in this little bit of pivoting, can you talk to us a little bit about Every Woman's Marathon? Because I want you to know, and I'm sure you know this already, the firestorm in the group chats when that race was announced was no joke. Like, no joke. If any of my friends in our She Runs Miami group chat is listening to this, like y'all can recall, like people are like, did you see this? Did you see this? Did you see this? Did you see this? And everyone's like, okay, I'm signing up. Are you signed up? Are you signed up? And I'm like, but wait. This I'm in information overload at this moment. So can you are an intentional person. What is your intention behind this marathon?
So I was approached to be part of the marathon as they were building this what do you call it, like team of captains. And the idea around the marathon was to really create space for women and femme to feel like they could show up as their authentic selves and be part of, the running culture. And for me, I saw it as an opportunity to set a new standard for what a race means, right? Like all of these races that exist are often resistant to things like allowing for lactation stations and allowing for childcare and allowing for longer course times and allowing for people to use strollers, right? Like all of these races have said that these things are not possible or things that we don't want to focus on. And Every Woman's Marathon is saying, well, guess what? We're actually going to address all of these things. And for me, I think it's important to continue to challenge this narrative of something is not. Doesn't make sense, or is not possible, or is not a priority, and create spaces where those things are possible, right? So, also having, the range of captains from being, myself to Catherine Switzer, who, broke the mold and set the paved the way for so many other women, Des Linden, Dina Castor, right? Like all people in their own right who have made such powerful contributions to this sport to say, look, there's a new way of doing things. And of course, I understand the logistical and financial challenges that come with offering something like this. But if the running industry wants to survive, we need to make more space, not less space, for people to be part of it. And, running a marathon is a huge deal. Now, I've run several, and sometimes you lose sight of just how few people actually do it. And so our goal is by, getting groups of women like this excited, and not just women, right? Anybody is able to register for this race, but it is prioritizing women, is to get these groups relying on each other for support, and the captains, all of us showing that, bringing people into the community, right? Like this is all a big hype train to get folks excited to be in their bodies and moving their bodies. And hopefully other races take notice. And again, the standard of what is acceptable for a race becomes elevated. Like every race should have accommodations for pregnant people. Every race should have accommodations for breastfeeding, chest feeding people. Like that should just be the standard.
Yeah, I think that was. I remember the day it was announced because I was taking my youngest daughter. She has scoliosis and she wears a brace. And I was taking her to her appointment. And I know we're in the appointment and they're measuring her and doing all this stuff. And when I get out, I see three text messages from three of my friends. And they're like, did you see this? Let's do it. And I was like, okay. So, like, three individual people reached out to me, I think, maybe within half an hour of that going live on Instagram. And then later that day, it was the group chat that everyone was like, oh my God, this race. And I was like, again, for me, I'm like, okay, information overload. There's a lot going on. Like, I need to do my research. I need to understand like what this race is, because the reality is we're not used to seeing that, right? Like, we're not, what? I mean, I think I read somewhere, or if not, I'm just assuming that there's going to be like tampons and pads on display everywhere for people. And it's like, oh yeah, like I can't even think of a med tent on any of the races that I've done that they just have pads and periods there for runners to take, like something as
I
simple
mean,
as that.
yeah, and I think it's like when you live in a patriarchy, everything is centered around what is the best experience for a male-bodied person, right? And if so, of course, they're not thinking about all of the things that you need as somebody who menstruates or somebody again who has, has a baby to take care of. And so the idea is we have to reshift what's centered. We have to reshift men in the center of everything. And what are ways that we can accommodate all genders so that they can be comfortable and taken care of. Like, I mean, it's still, when I really think about it, it blows my mind that you go to the women's room and that there's toilet paper and you have to pay for a tampon. Like, we don't pay for toilet paper because men need it. We pay for a tampon because men don't need it, right? Like, and it's simple, but it's also really infuriating. And so I'm excited for this opportunity because it could just, again, blow all of this out of the water. Like, it is possible to accommodate more than just men in this industry.
Yeah, my shout out, I'm going to shout out Under Armour here because my youngest, again, she plays volleyball and she's on a team now, and we travel for her tournaments. And I think it was last month, it was a tournament in Orlando, Florida. And my family knows me very well. They had this big table in front of the Under Armour sign with hair ties, tampons, pads, like on display. I mean, like there's nothing hidden about it. Like if they were like in clear containers there. I took a picture, posted it on my Instagram, and my oldest is like, of course you're gonna take a picture. And my husband's like, I knew that the minute you saw that, you were gonna take a picture. I'm like, is it really that hard though? Like, that's the thing that kind of baffles me, especially when we're seeing the numbers, right? We're seeing the numbers that are telling us more and more women are getting into running, more and more women are doing distance running. So it's like it is bizarre to me, but it's also kind of looping it back to your book, right? It's that invisibility, visibility, hypervisibility, like all those layers of that, of like, okay, we're here and we're taking up space, and yet no space is being relinquished to us because it's not convenient for them.
Yeah, I mean, it all goes into power and who's making decisions. And the idea, this is, you see this in the running industry, but you see this in the United States, right? That e people are vote against their own self-interest in order to keep tradition, right? People. White people, white women in this country who voted for Trump at very high numbers, and I'm sure will vote for Trump again, even though this is a man that is incompatible with their values and who they are, right? But there's more of a sense of connection to whiteness and white supremacy than there is to their own values as a woman, right? So people often, people are not rational. People are highly irrational. And that is why, even when making things more accessible, making things more inclusive is the rational thing to do, rational from the sense of like morality, from the sense of dollars, from the sense of what's good, they will do something resistant because that's tradition and what they're used to. So, yes, men continuing to make all of the decisions in governing bodies. Industry movement industries continuing to, for example, bar trans and non-binary people, right? Like, these things are irrational, but it's also how human beings tend to operate,
Right.
right?
Well, it's because it's our brains like the binary, right?
Right.
Like we want it this or that. There's no space for the in between. And that's it. Change is uncomfortable, even when it's
Nobody wants to be,
necessary.
nobody wants to be uncomfortable, you know?
But that's, I mean, that's life, right? I find that a big part of life is, and again, like bringing it back to your book, right? Where it's find comfort in the discomfort. You're not going to disrupt things if you're not willing to be a little bit uncomfortable in doing so. So one of the things I really appreciated was your announcement in particular about the Every Woman's Marathon, because at first when I saw it, again, like I just got the Every Woman's Marathon, like their page. That was what people were sending me. But then you posted a reel and you're like, so we're going to Savannah. And you were like, yeah, slavery, all that happened here. And to me, this is just like the beginning of your book. You know, you have the two history timelines. And this, I felt like, okay, we can put 2024 as another one, because you talk about how we're running through history, which again, I feel like is a big theme of your book, of we are repairing the missing stories as we heal the story forward. Was Savannah, I mean, I don't know how involved you were in this, but was Savannah like the top choice? Or was were there other cities? Because again, watching yours, I'm like, okay, now I understand why Allison's here. Because yes, we're it's not just let's run through a city and like it's cool. It's let's actually like understand what we're doing. Because I mean, how many routes? And you did a beautiful job of covering this. I believe it was, I don't know if it was last year or the year before, but the Boston Marathon course and like the neighborhoods it runs through and whatnot. So yeah, Savannah, was that an intentional choice here? Is it just like a logistical choice? Is that an appropriate question to even ask?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that was that's not my I was not involved in any of the logistics of picking the place. And but for me, like I've never been to Savannah. I know that it's a beautiful place, but part of that beauty is because of the plantations and because of all of the ways that wealth was hoarded by white people at the expense of black people. And so when I said yes to this, I also was like, I am not going to just use language about how beautiful it is and how romantic it is. Like all of that romanticism is actually untrue. That's what white people can look at that and feel like it's romanticism, right? And black people look at that and see it as trauma and violence and evidence of our not being seen as human in this country, right? And so what I saw is like this is an opportunity to actually talk about that, right? And for me, I'm hopeful whether it's an official part of the weekend or not, I plan to host a walking tour in collaboration with, you know, one of the organizations on the ground there that will allow people to go through these same streets that we're going to run on and learn the history of the Gullah Geechee people of, you know, formerly enslaved folks who are really responsible for the culture, the food, everything that makes Savannah and other parts of, you know, the South beautiful. So yeah, I mean, I'm all about to, I'm not, I think we, in any opportunity where you feel discomfort about something, you need to lean in and learn more rather than sugarcoat it and deny it. So I'm excited about going to Savannah and learning. I don't know much about it, right? That's not my area of expertise, but learning from people who live there and contextualizing that, like, how do you still find joy in places that were the center of so much pain?
Yeah, and I think that's beautiful, because that's something that's always missing from these races. And I thought of you so much. I did this race a couple of weeks ago, and it was in Orlando. It's called the Best Damn Race, so shout out to them. And the race is just two loops. It's two loops downtown Orlando area, but as I'm running and I'm like, okay, this part is really pretty. And then we kind of run through the airport and then we run across Orlando public housing. And that actually made me smile, because I thought of something that you wrote in your book where it's like, let's show the people everywhere, because it's not only for me to see these different neighborhoods, but it's also for the people who live in these houses to see that, hey, we can run through here and it's, and like, We can do that. And I
Mm-hmm.
thought of you
And my
so
hope,
much.
in these examples is that there's also the race is also in community and in partnership with these neighborhoods, right? Like I think there's such an opportunity to be investing in the communities that you run through, because none of these relationships should be extractive. Like we're just gonna come through here and showcase the neighborhood. It should be, what are the ways that our race are gonna support this community and their needs? So that moving forward, this community is actually feels like this is their race, they're part of it, they're informing, they're making decisions, and they're, helping to co-lead the future of it.
Yeah, I love that because it's even thinking of what you just said. It's like, oh, I can totally envision a future in which their people who live in those communities are also outside cheering people on,
Right.
right? They're also like celebrating the people like you see.
Right. Rather than saying like, I hate that this race comes through and our street is down. Well, if you're in community with people and you're sh and also then, if there are vendors and business owners getting them engaged, then they too want to be a part of this, right? Like again, people want belonging. People want things to be mutually valuable. Nobody wants to feel taken advantage of. So I think it's just, it maybe takes longer because you have to be intentional, but there are absolutely ways that race organizations, events, et cetera, can be more collaborative in producing what they do.
Which is, to me, it's even hearing you say like it takes longer. I'm like, but does it? Like, if you're aiming for longevity in
Right.
hosting this event, does it really take that much longer to build those relationships and to nurture those relationships with people? I think it goes back to like, what's the effort people need to put in into that? So, okay, I have three more questions for you, and this question is gonna kind of be a two-parter, and it's just, how do you connect to your joy? And what do you have coming up that we can celebrate you in?
I mean, I love being outside. Right now I'm and this is something that you can celebrate me with. I'm training for Kilimanjaro. I'm gonna summit in June. And so it's forcing me to go out and do really long hikes. I'm now hiking like 3, 4 hours by myself, and I can't believe that if I hadn't signed up for Kilimanjaro, I would probably have never experienced these places, right? Washington is one of the most beautiful places, honestly, in the world, which is seems like a lot to say, but it really is so beautiful, and I can't believe that I would not have gone on these long hikes, right? So I love hiking, I love cycling, I just love moving my body outside in new ways. And yeah, this is gonna be the hardest thing I've ever done, so I'm really looking forward to that.
Hardest thing you've ever done, says the woman who founded a run club, who's ran marathon, who's a mother,
I mean, I do,
who's
yeah.
changing, who's written a book,
Okay,
changing
hardest thing
industry.
physically in a short time.
Okay. Can you tell us where we can find you? How else can we connect with you? And also just where's the best place to buy your book so you make the most money? I've always wanted to ask an author that. So thank you for
Yeah,
letting me
sure.
ask that.
Yeah, so you can follow me. My website is Allison, M as in Mary, Desir.com. That's also my Instagram. I also have a Patreon account, and that's where you can find everything that's coming up for me. The best place to buy my book right now is actually on my website, AllisonMDesir.com. So initially, when the book comes out, it doesn't make that much of a difference, and there's often no real way for the author to benefit directly. Now that the book has been out for a while, yeah, purchasing it for me is the best way because the money will come directly to me. And yeah, it's exciting because every day it seems like new people are encountering my book, which is the beauty of publishing a book. Publishing a book is really, really hard, but the book will always exist and be there for people when they're ready to receive it. And that's exciting.
And that's a different kind of legacy. Let me tell you, that's beautiful. Final question is, what final words do you have for us?
I would say that if there's something that you're thinking about that, always seems to come up in your mind, whatever it is start doing it. And start doing it not seeking perfection, right? Like you'll figure out things along the way. Everything that I've done, and honestly, I believe that nobody really knows what they're doing. Like we're all just figuring it out, right? But if you wait for the thing to be perfect, then it may never come out. It may never materialize. So if there's something in your mind and it keeps being something that like bugs you or that you always talk about with people in your inner circle, start pursuing that thing.
I love that. Allison, thank you so much for joining me and for just creating all that you're creating,
You're welcome.
because I listen, I know you were working hard in the beginning of the pandemic.
Oh,
So
yeah.
I really appreciate just everything that you've done for me, for running, for women, and thank you in advance for everything that you will do. So
You're welcome.
Allison,
I'll
thank
see
you
you
so
in
much.
November,
You
if not
will.
sooner.
Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Allison has been so impactful for me personally over the years, and I'm so grateful I was able to have this conversation with her. While I may feel easy to follow the current state of running, Allison reminds us that the true belonging comes from being seen and celebrated as a whole person. We can't say running is for everyone when there are structures in place that prevent people from getting started with running in the first place. If you are curious about the history of running and how running is what we know of it today, I highly recommend reading Running While Black. Being a runner means doing more than just running. It means understanding your role in how running moves forward and toward safe spaces for all. For more on Allison, give her a follow on Instagram at Allison M. Desir and check out her website and buy her book at AllisonMDesir.com. You can reach out to me on Instagram at The Cookie Runner or through my website at thecookierunner.net. You can also support this podcast with a rating, review, or a share. Until next time, run happy, run strong, and run true to you.